Welcome back to the deep dive. Today we are stepping onto pavement that isn't made of stone.
No, it's made of whalebone.
Exactly, whalebone. The air smells like salt, opium smoke, and industrial runoff.
Yeah.
And the government, well, it's not a king or a council, it's just known as the company.
Right. We are opening up the Holland Codex today.
We are, and we're looking specifically at the Apocrypha journals, which cover the first four games, or narrative movements.
And I think calling them movements is really appropriate because this isn't your standard dungeon crawl. You know,
oh, not at all.
It reads much more like an industrial noir thriller that, well, it accidentally stumbles into a high magic genocide.
That is the perfect way to frame it. It's messy, it's gritty, and the stakes just escalate so fast it'll make your head spin. So for you listening, our mission today is to track the narrative arc of a very specific party of adventurers investigating a series of kidnappings.
Right, and to understand why the story plays out the way it does, you really have to understand the party dynamic first. They are a microcosm of the city itself.
Definitely. So let's introduce them. You have Elgis Linkshire, who is this disgraced noble with purple-pink hair. He wields a halberd.
Yeah, and Elgis is desperate to outdo his father, Garth.
Who is a former company board member, right?
Exactly. So Elgis represents that felon aristocracy trying to claw its way back up the ladder.
Then you have the muscle, Kiltak Bloodbane. He's a barbarian fighter with a great sword named Oathkeeper. He's seeking vengeance for his murdered parents.
A very classic, grounded setup for a fantasy character.
It is. But then there's Virgil. And I have to say, I love Virgil.
Virgil is the wild card of the group.
He really is. He's an orphan rogue. But his defining trait is that he is a strict religious skeptic.
Right. He prays to a god named Ajana, but he expects absolutely nothing in return.
It's this very cynical worldview that clashes so beautifully with the high magic threats they end up facing.
And rounding out the group, we have the warlocks.
Right, Hamza, the masked warlock who is there early on, and then Hayden Greymark, a trickster warlock who joins up a bit later.
So the stage is set, and we can dive into segment one. The narrative kicks off in the administrative district of Dunham with a classic noir trope.
The missing children.
Exactly. Two infants, Luna Whitman and Flora Shaw, have vanished.
And these aren't just any kids. They're the children of company board members. These are high-profile families.
So initially, the party, and you, the listener, probably thinks this is kidnapping for leverage.
Standard political maneuvering. You know, give me a seat on the board and I'll give you your kid back.
Right. But the details at the crime scene just don't add up. The party investigates and they find large feathers.
And feathers imply a beast, not a political blackmailer. Unless the blackmailer is a giant bird.
Which, knowing the setting of Holland, really isn't impossible.
Fair point. But this clue actually leads them to the home of a man named Ash Turner.
And eventually, to a major confrontation at the Volstead house. This is where the genre violently shifts from detective story to horror.
Oh, absolutely. They find Ash Turner trying to stop a beautiful woman from taking a third baby. But when the party intervenes,
the woman drops the disguise.
Yeah, and she's a harpy. She murders Ash Turner right there.
This is our first major lore insight into Holland. In most fantasy settings, harpies are, you know, screeching monsters on a cliffside diving at you.
Right. Bridge troll type encounters.
But here, they're infiltrating high society. They're using a specific item they found on her body called the Ring of Greater Pulchritude.
It's made of dimpled iron, and it allows the wearer to cast disguise self.
Which is a terrifying implication. It means anyone you meet in Holland, the aristocrat, the merchant, the nanny, could be a monster wearing a glamour.
It introduces this pervasive paranoia right from the jump. It totally destabilizes the social contract of the city.
And before Ash Turner dies, he manages to gasp out some dying words. He says, "Laurel Ulm, they'll kill Laurel Ulm's monument."
The classic dying breadcrumbs. But before we get to the monument, we have to talk about why the babies were taken. Because this isn't random hunger.
No, it's not. The party consults a contact, Gregor the Naturalist, who drops the concept of changelings.
Which is a term we hear a lot in folklore. But how does the Codex say it functions in Holland?
It's highly transactional. Gregor explains that fairies in this world exchange their own kin for human infants.
They swap them.
Right. So the missing children, they aren't human babies being stolen in the traditional sense. They are fairy children being reclaimed.
Or stolen back, depending on how you look at it.
Exactly. And that recontextualizes the entire mission. They aren't just saving babies anymore.
They are stepping into an interspecies Cold War.
Yes. And that war, seems to hinge on a very specific resource. Because while they are investigating this, the party learns about a secondary crime.
The theft at the penance chapel. Someone stole the penance stone.
And this is easily the most fascinating piece of magic system design in these journals. The penance stone isn't just a rock.
No, it absorbs psychic weight. It literally sucks the guilt out of anyone who touches it.
Which begs the question, who needs to stockpile that much human guilt?
Is it a drug? Is it a weapon?
That's the central mystery of game one. You have missing changelings, and you have a battery charged with sin. The connection isn't obvious yet, but the party knows it's bad.
Especially after they fight the thieves who took the stone. These women who move like martial artists but have extra eyes hidden under their skin.
Pure body horror to go with the psychological horror.
Yeah, Holland does not pull punches. So following Ash's dying clue, they head to Ulm's monument in game two.
And if you're listening to this and picturing a nice bronze statue in a park, erase that image completely.
Oh, yeah. Ulm's monument is a Gothic cathedral, but it is essentially a front.
Right. Beneath it, the party finds an industrial-scale salt mine that has been repurposed as an ossuary.
We're talking walls entirely lined with human skulls and femurs. The intro mentioned the city is built on bones. It wasn't a metaphor.
Literally the architecture. But the workers down in the catacombs aren't mining salt anymore. They are mining meteoric iron.
Let's pause on that for a second. For those not deep into fantasy lore, why is meteoric iron so significant?
Well, in many folklore traditions, cold iron is harmful to fairies.
Right.
Meteoric iron in Holland is that concept turned up to 11. It is toxic, fatal, essentially radioactive to fae creatures.
So finding a mine full of it implies industrial-scale weaponization against the fairies.
Exactly. And the party actually gets into a fight with the workers here. It's a great tactical moment where they use a bottleneck tunnel and oil to defeat them.
Smart play. But after the fight, they find the real smoking gun down in the mines. A spell lab.
Yes, a hidden spell lab, complete with a cipher disc.
And this scene is fantastic because it balances the grim horror with the inherent incompetence of the protagonists. We have to remember this is based on a role-playing game.
Right, so Virgil, the rogue, the guy whose entire job is to be clever, tries to decode the disc.
And he rolls a one on his intelligence check.
A critical failure. The log literally notes that he received a red rejected sticker.
I love that so much. It reminds us that these aren't flawless superheroes. They're just people, and sometimes they fail miserably.
So they eventually have to swallow their pride and take it to Annie at the Quaternion Society to crack the code.
And what the decoded letters reveal makes the humor evaporate instantly.
Completely. The letters outline a conspiracy led by two figures named Ischuld and Astrid.
And they're developing a ninth level necromancy spell.
Which, for context, is essentially god-tier magic.
Yeah, world-altering power. And the spell is called Fae Extinction Event.
The name leaves very little to the imagination. It's a magically induced genocide.
And the mechanism for this. They plan to use the stolen penance stone to power the spell at the Cathedral of Gratzka.
So they're using the collective guilt of the human city as the fuel to instantly wipe out every fairy in existence.
Weaponizing the conscience of the city against the other, it is so poetically dark.
It really is. But look at the party's reaction to this, because this is where the deep dive gets really interesting regarding their morality.
Oh, the blacksmith scene.
Yes. They know meteoric iron kills fairies. They know someone is trying to wipe out the fairies. And yet, Elgis and Kiltak immediately go to a smith named Kazola.
And they commission weapons made out of meteoric iron.
They arm themselves with the very poison that kills the people they might be trying to save.
It perfectly highlights the moral ambiguity of Holland. They are pragmatic above all else.
Right. There is no pure heroism here. They need the best weapons to fight the bad guys, even if those weapons are anathema to the victims.
They are quite literally fighting poison with poison.
Exactly. And speaking of things that aren't pure, let's pivot into game three. We move from the grim salt mines to the social heart of Holland, the Black Cabaret.
The tonal shift here is wild. The Black Cabaret is described as a theater of the absurd. The source material mentions men in horse costumes. There are clowns.
It's chaotic, loud, and completely nonsensical.
And right in the middle of this fever dream, Virgil decides to enter a trampoline contest.
Because of course he does.
He goes up against the master of ceremonies, a character named Canker Blossom.
And Canker Blossom is a key figure here. He actually wins the contest with a song about murdering the master of revels.
Which the audience thinks is just a joke, just a bit of dark satire.
Right. But we ask you to keep that in mind because truth in Holland is so often hidden in plain sight, disguised as entertainment.
While this absurd contest is happening, The rest of the party spots another disguised harpy in the crowd, Ursula.
And the interrogation that follows is intense. It's not a polite conversation in a back room.
Not at all. Kiltak grapples her, and Hamza threatens her with a spear that is literally crackling with energy.
They force her to give up the location of the kidnapped babies. She tells them they are at the Eyrie, out in the abandoned town of Lofton.
Which leads to a journey that I think perfectly encapsulates the action comedy element of this story.
They travel to Lofton and immediately encounter these silver bugs that burrow into their skin.
Just gross.
And then they have to descend a cliff to get down to the harpy nest. Kiltak is carrying the tied up hostage, Ursula, down the cliff face.
And he rolls a 2 on his athletics check.
He drops her. He drops the key witness, and she falls to her death.
It's tragic, but in the context of the game mechanics, it's a fumble that forces them to go into the enemy lair completely blind.
That blend of high stakes and human error again. So they finally reach the Eyrie.
Describe the Eyrie for us.
It's this massive cavern featuring a bone well that drops 500 feet straight down. And chained up near the edge, they find a man.
Christopher Cotton.
Right. And he claims he was kidnapped along with Livingston, who is the master of revels.
The guy from Canker Blossom's song.
Exactly. Christopher says he was forced to watch the harpies eat Livingston.
It's a gruesome story, perfectly designed to elicit sympathy. You know, save me, I'm the victim here.
But the party is sharper than they look. They notice that Christopher is still wearing jewelry.
Right. If he had been stripped and tortured by monsters, they definitely would have taken the shiny things. The greed gave the disguise away.
Christopher is actually the harpy Duchess Hecate in disguise.
So they fight her, defeat her, and they eventually find the real Christopher Cotton, along with the changeling babies, Luna and Flora.
And as a bonus, they loot an item called the Necklace of the Cool Appraising Stare.
I just want to go on record saying that is the best name for a magic item I've ever heard.
It fits the theme perfectly. Everything in this arc is about perception versus reality. Disguise rings, changelings, cabaret acts.
A necklace that helps you appraise things, see their true value, is thematically spot on.
So now they have the babies. The immediate kidnapping threat is resolved.
But the Fae extinction event clock is still ticking in the background.
And this brings us to a massive sociological dilemma as we enter game 4. They have the babies, but they know they are changelings.
Fairies swapped at birth. These aren't the human children the parents think they are.
So the party has to debate. Do they tell the human mothers the truth?
This is the part of the logs that hit me the hardest. It's such a deeply human problem in the middle of a magical world.
They decide to tell Mia Whitman. And Kiltak is very blunt about it. He just says, your baby is a fairy.
And Mia's reaction is total denial. She thinks he's insane.
She rejects it outright. She creates a defensive wall because she refuses to accept the magical reality invading her life. It's simply too painful.
Now contract that with the second mother, Zoe Shaw. The party decides not to tell her.
They just hand the baby back, and she is overjoyed. She accepts the child without question.
Ignorance is bliss.
In Holland, ignorance is survival. The contrast between the magical reality of the world and the mundane refusal of its citizens to believe in it is staggering.
But the party can't dwell on the ethics of that life for too long because they finally track the mastermind, Astrid, to the Cathedral of Gradska.
And the set piece here is highly cinematic. The cathedral is a complete ruin.
Astrid is standing in the center of a pentagram of fire,
which the source calls a circle of nerf and blight. She's using the dome of the cathedral, almost like Cerebro from the X-Men.
There are lights flickering on the ceiling, tracking the location of every fairy in the world.
And she is actively casting the Fae extinction event, using the stolen pendant stone as the battery.
The stakes could not be higher. So the party jumps in. They have to fight through a defensive line first, which includes Beatrice, the woman with the extra eyes from the chapel, and a squad of devils.
But the mechanics of the fight are what make it terrifying. Talk about the nerfed blight.
So Astrid has created this 30-foot radius circle of necrotic energy. It deals massive damage. But the kicker is, it moves.
It moves around the battlefield on initiative count 20.
Yes. So the terrain itself is actively hostile. Every round, the safe zones change.
You're trying to stop a genocide, dodge devils, and make sure you aren't standing in the circle when it shifts, or you just rot away.
It forces the party to be incredibly mobile and tactical. They manage to take Beatrice down, and then they focus all their fire on Astrid.
And Kiltak, true to form, executes her. But not before they extract the location of the other conspirator, Shild.
They learn that the circle the fairies gather in mushroom rings, and that Ishild is hiding in a lair under Gramercy books.
But the immediate crisis is over. They stop the spell, and they begrudgingly return the pendant stone to Merrick the Sexton.
Which honestly feels like giving a loaded gun back to a toddler, considering he failed to protect it the first time.
It does. But they don't have a better option. But there's a quiet moment amidst all the post-fight chaos that we really need to highlight.
Virgil.
Yes. Virgil, our skeptic, prays to Ajana right there in the ruined cathedral.
And this time he receives an actual answer.
He does. The voice speaks to him and says, "The true name of Ajana is every true statement that can't be proven true."
Every true statement that can't be proven true. That is remarkably deep for a fantasy setting. Let's unpack that.
It is philosophically fascinating. Because if something can be proven, it's science. Or it's a verifiable fact, it's measurable.
Right.
Faith lives in the gap where proof fails. It's the domain of intuition, hope, and the things you just know are real but can't demonstrate on paper.
It's the perfect theology for a rogue who relies on luck. Luck isn't a statistic you can prove exists, but you absolutely know when you have it.
Exactly. It completely validates his skepticism while simultaneously confirming his faith. It's brilliant.
So the world is saved. The babies are home. We move into the outro of the journals, which sees the party in a boardroom meeting with the Volsteads.
You'd expect a parade or a medal ceremony, maybe a key to the city.
Instead, they get more work. Classic corporate life. Good job stopping the apocalypse. Here's your next assignment.
They are thanked, but then immediately given new leads. A mishap at the Admiralty Brig. A missing prosthetist named Vorman.
And crucially, they are asked to investigate the disappearance of the Master of Revels.
The guy they know is dead.
They literally saw his bones in the Harpy Well at the Eyrie.
They know, but the company doesn't. And in Holland, that information asymmetry is power.
They are walking out of that boardroom holding a secret that could topple the social order if they reveal it to the wrong person.
It really forces you to look at the power structure of the city as a whole. Throughout the logs, there's constant mention of something called the lion's mouth.
The anonymous snitching system.
Right. It's an iron mail slot where citizens accuse their neighbors of crimes or sedition with zero accountability.
And this brings us to the big takeaway from these four games. If the good guys, the board, the people paying the party, rely on a system of anonymous accusations to maintain order.
Are they actually any better than the forces the party just defeated?
Are they better than the harpies or the extinction cultists?
That's the lingering question. It suggests that the structure of Holland is rotten to the core. And remember Canker Blossom's song from the cabaret?
He sang about murdering the Master of Revels openly on stage. Everyone laughed.
But he likely knew the truth all along. Was it a confession disguised as a joke?
Which means in Holland, the truth is a joke, and justice is just a mail slot away. It's a messy, compromised world where even the heroes have to get their hands dirty with meteoric iron and lies.
And that's what makes the Holland Codex such a compelling read. It challenges the adventurers not just to kill the monster, but to navigate a society that might actually be the real monster.
A cheery thought to end on, but a necessary one. That is a wrap on our deep dive into the first four games. I want to throw a final thought out to you listening.
Think back to that moment with the mothers.
Yes. Would you have told them about the changelings? Is the painful truth always required, or is the comforting lie sometimes better?
It's the ultimate utilitarian question for this setting.
Let us know what you think. We'll see you in the next deep dive.